Do I am here? I am here.
We're here.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah.
A standing O for the Carl Landry Record Club.
Yeah, feels good. Feels good.
Mootloo right there. I'm Spike. Carl Landry Record Club Music Pod from the Rights Ricky Sanchez Music Appreciation Pod. I actually explained the pod to somebody at work. Who was it? Leslie Scott. Who works for our corporate digital team and worked in music radio for a long time. We were talking about music radio, blah, blah, blah. She's like, I do this podcast where we just suggest music to each other and talk about it. And it's good and it's fun. And her eyes lit up, I guess. Well, maybe.
So we might have a new...
Probably not.
New supporter of the pod?
Maybe at least in terms of her energy. Love the idea of it. So the idea of the pod is truly what I just said. The idea of the pod is like in this world where we get suggested music through our apps and keeps you in the same box. We like talking about music and we like suggesting music the old-fashioned way, like humans. So every pod, Mootloo and I pick an album that we love and we talk about it. And then we pick a listener album that you love and we talk about it. And the goal is to find, even if it's not down your alley, is to find something that you like about it. What did you like about this? You know, talk about it in a fun and interesting way, and also find something that you like. If you want to suggest an album, just there's so many different ways. You tweet us at CLRCpod. You can leave a review in the Apple Podcast reviews. If you're listening on Spotify, right under the pod, we've been getting suggestions there. It'll say, what's the next album we should do? You could do it there. Or just go to CarlLandryRecordClub.com. You can shoot us an email. Today's is an email. We haven't done an email in a while. So
today's pick. Oh, okay. And yeah, it was pick. Interesting that the pick today.
Interesting that because I go through the listener suggestions. So interesting that I picked it is what you're saying.
Because this is the second time you've selected a Springsteen album as a listener pick.
So the albums we're doing today, it is Moot's week in terms of album selection on our side. So Moot's album is Duffy's Rock Fairy, which came out in 2008. Yes.
Yes, indeed. Yes,
08. Indeed. And the listener album sent such a thoughtful email. Pat, I'm not going to read last name, but Patty sent the listener email, and that came 1980s Bruce Springsteen's The River. Patty says this. What's the album we did last time? The
Nebraska. Which I like that record a lot. Mm-hmm. Probably a little more than this one, but...
Very different record. Incredible. Yeah, really different. Yeah. So Patty says, I love your podcast show, guys. Live in Geelong, Australia, a child of the 70s. Really appreciate your deep dive into grunge 90s and opening up my appreciation of more recent music. I especially enjoy the technical / mixing / sound analysis, which isn't always obvious to the everyday listener. That always comes from Moot. Would you review Springsteen's The River? The River is the sound of my childhood and has formed the soundtrack of my life. Not from being the music played in my childhood home, which vibrated to my parents' taste, Dylan, Hendrix, Otis, Janis, and Sabbath. Springsteen was a bit too brassy for my folks, a bit too mainstream. So it is the sound of shopping centers, radio, roller skating, and friends' homes. The song The River gives me chills every time I hear it. The harmonica solo haunting and the lost hurts of teenage love, lifelong drudgery, and painful memories, so simply and eloquently put. Quote, now I just act like I don't remember, and Mary acts like she don't care. Age 46 now, these lyrics strike a painful emotion, but also a comfort in lifting the everyday to the universal experience. Thanks, guys, and happy holidays.
Wow, that was a thoughtful review.
How could you know? I've documented. It's well documented that I'm not a Bruce guy, but how do you read this email and not say, "Oh, yeah, we'll do your album. We'll definitely do your album."
Yeah, now it totally makes sense. That was such a thoughtful just interesting perspective to hear, both on the pod and her connection to the music in general. I love that. I love that.
I thought it was interesting she said, and why don't we do Springsteen first? I thought it was interesting she said she was a child of the 70s in that, like, but all, or but also that she's 46 and I'm 46 and I consider myself, even though I was born in the 70s, I consider myself a child of the 80s.
Yeah.
And even to, I would consider myself a child of the 90s more than a child of the 70s even because of, you know, through the 90s, I'm still through my teen years. You know, I don't consider, like this album for me is before I would have paid attention directly to music. Like I think like the first Springsteen album I remember in my lifetime as being relevant to me is Born in the USA, which I think is 84, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think of, I often talk about 87 in terms of like albums that I really, really loved. But even before that, I think of like Thriller and Born in the USA. And so this album was before my time, but who knows, you know, how culture is there, may have stuck around a little bit longer and all that sort of stuff. So we don't need to do, we've done a Springsteen album before. Everybody knows who Springsteen is. We certainly don't need to do a biography on Bruce Springsteen. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about like the making of the album and the context of the album. And then we can talk about the album itself, which I listened to while cleaning. I listened to the first time around in the car over like three car trips because it's long. And then the second time I listened while cleaning the house yesterday. And I noticed a couple of other things while I was listening yesterday. This is Springsteen's only double album. It is a double album. It's his fifth album.
Sprawling, I would say. Yes. Close to 90 minutes.
The first time I listened to it, I did not look at how long it was. And what Spotify does is, I listen to the music on Spotify. What it does is once an album ends, it'll start playing you like similar stuff afterwards. And there were a couple times when I was like, oh, I must be at the similar stuff portion. I was like, nope, a record's still going. So it's his fifth album. It is the first Springsteen album to go number one on Billboard, which it sat for a month. It was produced by Bruce Springsteen, Stevie Van Zandt, and John Landau, who is a famous supporter of Springsteen and operated more, not just as a producer, but as like a manager and like called Springsteen the future of rock and roll, like a huge supporter of his.
And he was a Rolling Stone writer originally, wasn't he?
Correct.
Pre-Springsteen days.
Yep. So it's 79 and Bruce sat down to record an album. He recorded an album. What was it called? It was the track on this album. It was, wait, hold on. I thought I wrote this down, but I didn't write it down. The album initially was called, hold on. How did I not write this down? But I don't want to miss this. That's why I'm looking it up as we talk about it. When he submitted the album, it was called... What am I doing here? So the one before was Darkness on the Edge of Town. And then, hold on.
That one was sort of the follow-up to his true breakthrough, which I think was Born to Run.
Yes.
The third one.
Correct. Okay, so it was called The Ties That Bind. And he submitted it, 10 songs. So it went so far as to, label was pretty thrilled because they thought they would have it in time for Christmas of 79. Submitted it to be mastered, it comes back, and he decides when it comes back that he didn't think it was done. And he said, the song, quote, the songs lack the kind of unity and conceptual intensity I liked my music to have. And Landau actually suggested doing a double album and went back into the studio and recorded 50 songs for The River.
Wow.
And ended up putting 20 of them on double album. Who knows how long this album would have been if we were in the digital age where you could fit more than, how much can you fit on an LP? Like 48 minutes or something like that?
Yeah. And on CD, you could do
70, long. 68.
Is 70 the max on the CD?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, at the time that CDs were there. So one of the things that happened as it came back is that like the concept of the album like went from being, I guess, nothing, as he said, in The Ties That Bind, to being like an up and down and up and down and a lightness versus darkness thing, which you can certainly hear as you're listening. And Springsteen said, rock and roll has always been about this joy, this certain happiness that in its way is the most beautiful thing in life. But rock is also about hardness and coldness and being alone. And I finally got to a place where I realized life had paradoxes, a lot of them, and you've got to live with them. So as I say, end up doing a double album. That is The River. It's released. It ends up hitting, it sold 5 million copies in its, from its release until now. He has done the album in its entirety a lot. In 2015, I think they put out a box set and ended up doing a tour where he did The River sort of beginning to end a bunch. It was in 2009 at a concert. He said, "The River was a record that was the gateway to a lot of my future writing. It was a record that we made after The Darkness on the Edge of Town, and it was a record made during a recession, hard times in the States. It's the title song I wrote for my brother-in-law and my sister. My brother-in-law was in the construction industry, lost his job, and had to struggle very hard back in the late 70s, like so many people are doing today. This was 2009, remember, after another recession. It was a record in which I first started to tackle men and women and families and marriage. There are certain songs on it that led to complete records later on. The River sort of went on to the writing of Nebraska, Stolen Car, went to the writing of Tunnel of Love. Originally, it was a single record. I handed it in with just one record and took it back because it didn't feel big enough. I wanted to capture the themes I had been writing about on Darkness. I wanted to keep those characters with me and at the same time added music that made our live show so much fun and love for our audience. So in the end, we're going to take you down the river tonight," and did the whole album.
Some good quotes from the boss.
For sure. It also contained his first top 10 pop single, which, Hungry Heart. Everybody's got a hungry heart. Everybody's got a hungry heart. Lay down your money and you pray your heart. Everybody's got a
hungry. My favorite Springsteen song.
I don't know if you know this. It was written initially for the Ramones.
Really?
Yes. Ended up being a Bruce song. And so I went in with an open mind.
Uh-oh. Why does this feel ominous now?
No, I sort of liked it. There's a lot of Bruce influence on a lot of the music I like. But when you listen to all of these bands, whether it be the Gaslight Anthem or the Killers or the National or any of the bands that are influenced by
Gang of Youths, I would say.
Gang of Youths, certainly. Certainly the last, certainly Go Farther and Lightness. There's a ton of Bruce in it. But it's all like, it comes from different places. And I would say that when you listen to the Gaslight Anthem, I hear this album in them more than I hear any other Bruce. Like when I think of the Killer, Sam's Town, I don't think of this album. Or when I listen to Chuck Reagan, I don't think of this album. Or the National, I don't particularly think of this album. But Gaslight Anthem, I think of this album. I think, you know, it was funny, like one thing I noticed about the album, and I played it for my wife yesterday, is I was like, she was like, "Why do you keep singing, I want to wish you a Merry Christmas?" And I was like, "Because you can sing it to every song on this album." And I started playing her songs on the album. And I was like,
and just doing it to every
and
track.
And doing it. And like, look, I usually add the music in afterwards, of course. But if you do it, like, let's do it. And then I promise I'll get to like less goofy things. But if you do it like on this one, I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I want to wish you a Merry... All right. So then you go to the next one. Right? Just like, I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I want to wish you...
Oh, my goodness. Is this the next track now?
Yeah, I'm just going through one after one. Anyway, you get the point.
Wow. So you did this for the whole record? And
Val.
She cut it off. She said enough of this.
I got through four tracks, and she started laughing because then she started doing it. And she decided that Two Hearts was the best. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. Two hearts are better than one. Two hearts are better than one. I did like this. I did find tunes that I liked. I did really enjoy some of the slower tracks and some of the upbeat tracks. I did think the album is tedious. If I'm like to criticize it in any way, I think like you could go through this album and make a, and this is what's difficult, right? Because at the time you couldn't make a 60-minute album. You could make a 48-minute album or a 90-minute album because of the way that the music was distributed. But there are times when I'm listening to it, I'm just like, oh my God, I don't need another one of these. But the things that I like really, and like, first of all, Ties That Bind is an awesome tune. And like the opening track on the album. And it is sort of like when you think of the Heartland Rock sort of Springsteen, you know, upbeat, like that sort of thing. I think it is, you could make an argument that is like the quintessential one. There's a lot of them, but that one really struck me. I really like The River. And for my 19th birthday, I got a union card and a wedding coat. We went down to the courthouse and the judge put it all to it. No way. The title track in that, it's sort of like equal parts power ballad and like John Mellencamp Heartland Rock. Like, I think you can hear both of them in there, like almost Poison meets John Mellencamp. I tried to, one of the things I had to not ignore, but like, but not be actively like making fun of, is the lyrics. It can be a little silly. Like, me and Mary met when we were in high school when she was just 17. We like, it's funny when Nickelback does it, everybody makes fun of them, but when Bruce does it, it's just like,
is this, does this, now you mentioned those kind of lyrics,
and yeah,
a lot of his songs are like character studies in a way.
Sure. Yes. And
but I've heard you say in the past that perhaps that's the thing that irks you a little bit about him, is that he creates those kind of characters that are sort of blue collar,
well, I,
working
I
th- class characters, and you feel there's a lack of authenticity or something in the.
Well, I think what I think tends to happen. I don't want to do this too much because I do think it's a,
we've
fun
already
record.
Done it 15 yeah. times before. So
I do think you could take the songs from this record, make a playlist, and make like a nearly perfect album that is like a little less tedious. But I think what happens is like he ends up, rather than these characters, all right, let's take a movie with characters in it. If it's a well-done movie and it's a movie about these characters, you don't walk away identifying the character with the personality of the person who played the character. Like, in the best movies ever, like there's a little bit of like vague association, but if it's a good actor and a well-written script, you walk away feeling for the character, not right. the person who's playing the character. And I think the thing that he has maybe done, whether it is on purpose or not on purpose, or whether it's his fans that do it or whatever, is that like he has sort of, the characters that he is writing about, people identify as him.
Right.
And he sort of comes off as this like grinding working man who, and like that whole, and he's not the only one, right? Like there are plenty of like
John Mellencamp, you can say the same kind of thing.
Right. Sure. Though I would say John Mellencamp, I don't perceive John Mellencamp getting on stage as like a coal miner. Like John Mellencamp seems like he's singing silly fun songs to me. So that is where I struggle a little bit, is that like he is not that person. And I think people take the characters he sings about and sort of like plant them on his life and his value system, which is not, certainly not, you know, crazy, but when you keep writing about the same sort of character over and over and over again, like I could see how that would happen.
Well, I'm thinking about the Liz Phair record we discussed where.
Right.
But if I'd known how that would sound to you, I would have stayed in your bed for the rest of my life.
listened to that album and thought, oh, this is her, this is autobiographical. And then here we discover that these were characters she made up.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's sort of an author, a storyteller.
But she didn't continue to write
She evolved,
albums
right.
about, like, young girls.
Right.
You know, so whatever. Other songs I really liked, and then, I really liked Stolen Car in the same way that I like The River.
We almost always key in on a few of this. That's one of the best songs on the record.
And I actually really like the lyrics on this. Like I thought they were pretty touching. She asked if I remember the letters I wrote when our love was young and bold. She said last night she read those letters and it made her feel 100 years old. I'm driving a stolen car on a pitch black night and I'm telling myself it's going to be all right. But I ride by the night and I travel in fear that in this darkness I'll disappear. It's great lyric writing there.
Yeah.
Now he's got to throw in that the car is stolen in some like bullshit fucking right. Good lyric.
Yeah. And good
then,
lyric.
Yeah. And then
don't go down that other road.
Yeah. And then the other one that I like that actually is a band that we haven't talked about in terms of Bruce influence is I think if you listen to The Price You Pay. Like that's a mid-tempo Wallflowers tune. And like, I don't often think about the Wallflowers as Bruce influence. I do think if the Wallflowers were to break onto the scene today, people would talk about Bruce, you know, but like that tune, I think it's really interesting. It's like 5.5 minutes, but when I think that album feels a little tedious sometimes, I don't think that song does at all. It's pretty long for a Bruce song. And I think it's a great tune. Those were the ones that stuck out to me. But I did, as soon as I put it on, it's hard to not like bop around a little bit when you're like listening to these tunes, you know?
Well, yeah, I'm going to sort of piggyback on that idea about this record because just starting off, I'll kind of jump around, but we mentioned The Ties That Bind. That's a great album opener.
Yeah.
That one and Sherry Darling, they kick off the record with this like heavy bar band vibe, you know? Something about the extended sax solos. And I got to say, Clarence Clemons is a big part of this record.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I've always known that, but I recognize it even more somehow with this album.
Have you seen, you probably haven't, there's a guy, this is what it makes me think of. There's a guy on TikTok that puts sax solos in songs that don't have them already. And it's really fucking awesome, actually. And it reminds me of, like, you don't hear a ton of sax solos in, you know, rock and roll songs or whatever. Like, there's one on the Lost Boys soundtrack. It's really just Bruce songs, but it's so fucking, like, it crushes each song. In a positive way when it comes in there. It just elevates it the way that a solo is supposed to elevate it, and it makes it, like, feel like a party when that part of the song shows up.
That's what the sax and horn sections in general have the ability to do.
Yeah.
Now, this isn't as much about horn sections. This is about sort of one player who just adds this whole other dimension to it. But you hear those songs, and that's the vibe you get. You know, listening to those first few tracks, you get some of that raw, visceral energy that I think Springsteen and the E Street Band are known for live. Like, you can kind of get a snapshot of what they do live.
Yeah.
From listening to those first few songs. And then when I think of those and some of the others on the record, there's kind of like a sing-along vibe. Like, you hear like kind of the group vocal dynamic, and he kind of plays off that, which I love. You know, it's almost like if you dropped in on a jam session or just a small gig at a small bar, let's say in Asbury Park, because that makes perfect sense, you know? Yep. It's like you dropped in on that, and that's the vibe you get. The other thing I'll say about Sherry Darling and some of the other tunes like it.
Back
is, and one thing I recognize about him is he channels a lot of the early rock and roll sound. You know, late 50s and into the early 60s style of rock and roll. You think about Roy Orbison, but even just the first wave of rock and roll, like, I think that's part of his sound that maybe I didn't recognize quite as much, is that you don't necessarily hear a lot of contemporary rock artists who say came out of the 70s who went back to that particular strand of the music. And he's always channeled that, which then gets me to Hungry Heart, which is probably my favorite song of his.
Which, by the way, I mean, like, just even like a tie to Elvis. Like,
yes, you can hear
Elvis in this record all over the place. You could imagine Elvis singing these songs. You could, like, that rock and roll, but has, you know, like early rock and roll did have rhythm and blues in it, and have like that tie. I think you can hear Elvis and Bruce.
That's a great point you made, that early form of rock and roll was closely connected to early R&B. I mean, see, now we think of those two genres as very separate. You know, we think of like Genuine as an artist, is an R&B and soul artist, is light years away from Gaslight Anthem, right? Stylistically. But if you look at those two styles and you go back to the 50s, even the late 40s, they kind of, there was much more overlap. And I think that's part of what has made Bruce Springsteen successful, is that, yes, he's a rock and roll artist, but there's also that early R&B influence in what he does. He just released an album of soul covers, which I haven't listened to the full record, but the first single is really good. It's all covers. It's a song called, I think it's called Do I Love You? You know, I saw the video for it. It's like a big band, and he's doing more of kind of a soul singer kind of Springsteen kind of thing. You know, his version of it.
Yeah.
It's why I love Hungry Heart, because I think Hungry Heart channels that area that we're talking about, that early rock and roll slash early R&B, I think it channels that energy.
Well, it's also a tie between, that song is, I think, the perfect tie between the record previous to this, the Bruce Darkness and the Edge of Town, and Born in the USA. Like that is the step in between Dancing in the Dark and, you know, and prior Bruce. And I think that is the, you know, that you probably talk to Bruce fans that like wish he hadn't continued with that step or whatever, who don't like the poppier stuff there. But I think it's an obvious, if you're looking for the signs of where it's going, you can look into Hungry Heart specifically.
Yeah. See, I love that side, 'cause I'm obviously not a diehard fan, but I like, I like Bruce, but I don't like every aspect of what he does, but I like this aspect.
Right.
And also on that song, that sentiment, that's a sentiment you heard before. You've heard that in songs before this one and in many others since this one. But I would contend that this is one of the best versions of that sentiment that everyone can relate to, wanting to feel like love and connection, want to be part of something.
Absolutely.
Just the idea of everybody's got a hungry heart. I mean, he really nailed it writing-wise. And then back to Clarence Clemons on that one, when you really listen to the mix, the sax is like a rhythm part on that.
Yep.
You know, it's in a lower register, and it's like this, it's quite unique from a recording standpoint that the sax plays this kind of this rhythm section. It's not really soloing at all, at least not in the main body of the song. So I think that's an amazing track. Then you got like tracks like Out in the Street, which I think like sort of deliver a particular brand of, I don't know how else to put this, but the rock and roll bombast that is Springsteen, the E Street Band. You know, there's like a, I don't want to say it's like macho, but it's kind of like, it's like that kind of thing, you know?
Yep.
And those are probably the moments on the record that I don't enjoy as much. But, you know, you're talking about Stolen Car.
Yes.
Those two moments, the river, the title track, the river, and Stolen Car are two of the best moments on the record. And I'll draw, take it one step further. Stolen Car is in the movie Copland. Did you ever see that?
Yeah, with Sly.
Yeah, Sly is sitting
another
there.
Another guy who has assumed the role of his characters, by the way.
Right, and it's probably not that guy, really.
Yeah, probably not.
But there's a great scene where he's kind of sitting there at his house feeling dejected, and that song comes on, which I kind of feel like that movie was a bit unheralded. I mean, it's
Copland's great. Leota is in it, too, right?
Leota, De Niro, Harvey Keitel. Yeah. Michael Rapaport. Michael Rapaport is great in that movie.
Yep. That is a cool movie. I saw that. I'll never forget when I was... So my guess is that movie came out in 97?
Yep, exactly.
Okay. So the reason I remember this is because my wife and I were watching the Prince Harry interview last night, which I don't even... Like, I barely know what is going on with all that, but there's
nothing... I
know
nothing about any of that.
So it was just on, but I was like... I was talking about it, and I was like, man, imagine being Princess Di's son. That's fucking wild. And then I remembered when Princess Di died, because I was in Boston... I was in college in Boston in August to watch a Red Sox game. And I remember those 3 days when we were in Boston, we also saw Copland, and I called it Copland because I didn't know that it was Copland.
Copland sounds right, actually.
Yeah,
Copland. It could be. Yeah, if it's someone's last name. It's a guy named Copland.
Copland. Yeah, I have no idea what it is. So anyway.
I would say when you watch that film, that's an amazing cast. Those are some of the greatest actors in the history of American cinema. But Ray Liotta.
Oh, crushes it.
Crushes it. He's the best actor in that film. Yep. And it's interesting to me that obviously De Niro and Keitel and those guys deservedly get the recognition that they do. But at his best, he's as good or better than those guys. Even when you think of Goodfellas.
Yep.
You know, another guy who everyone knows Ray Liotta, but kind of underrated in my opinion.
Yeah, he had a great career, you know. Absolutely great career. And sort of like a similar guy in almost everything he played, and almost became typecast as a fucking scumbag toward the end of his career because he looked like a fucking scumbag. Like, the best thing about Ray Liotta is that I don't know if he did drugs at all, but he always looked like he was coked up. Like,
especially in the later part of his career.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
But then I think of his role in Field of Dreams, you know?
Oh, yeah. Early in his career. That was early in his career, yeah, for sure. Yes, great, great Springsteen record. It was fun to listen to, for sure. I found the sax guy on TikTok, his name is Karsten Belt, and this is him adding a sax solo to Harry Styles' Sign of the Times.
Ah. It's perfect.
It's great, isn't it?
Yeah. Why wasn't that in the record?
I have no idea.
Amazing.
So that's his whole thing.
It would have been an even bigger hit.
Yeah,
if they would have put that in there.
Yeah. So thank you. I hope we did it justice. To Patty, who, and of course another Australian listener, which is just
we have a good amount of. Well, I know the Ricky does. I think we do as well.
We do too. I don't know what has happened with the media I produce being connected to Australians, but I think maybe it's because I like Australian artists. I think, and we've done a lot of Australian artists. But thank you. I hope we did it justice. So, Moot's selection this week is Duffy's Rock Fairy.
Oh, yes, you know what's going on. Cause the fears of me, oh, yes, me, are burning strong. But I will never be a stepping stone. Take it all.
When you first sent it along, Duffy's a blonde woman, I looked at it and I was like, Hillary Duff. It was my first, like, when I looked at it.
Oh, you thought it was Hillary Duff.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And then I brought
it
up.
Is that why? Because I'll be honest, I was confused by the interesting caps thing.
Yeah, I thought it was.
I thought
it was Hillary Duff.
Is he saying it's interesting because?
And then I listened to it and I was like, oh, this is not an interesting pick from Mootloo. I mean, like, it's a good record, but like, it's fucking right down the fucking middle for, so here we go. Came out in 2008. And I don't know anything about Duffy. So,
were you not familiar with this album?
Nope. Oh, never heard of it. Yeah,
I love this album. I became a huge fan of her and this record when it came out. This was her debut. Mm. Give a little backdrop on Duffy. She's a Welsh singer, born Amy Ann Duffy in 1984. Born and raised in Bangor, Gwynedd, North Wales.
Okay.
Had a twin sister and older sister. Now her parents split when she was 10, And for a time, she lived with her mothers and her sister. Now, she's had... I've been a fan of her music a long time. I didn't know a whole lot about her backstory. And researching her for this episode, she's been through some extremely traumatizing events in her life. The first one happening when she was younger. In September of 98, when she was 14, she was put in a police safe house because there was a plot that was uncovered that involved her stepfather's ex-wife planning to murder him.
Oh, wow. That sounds like a negative. It sounds like a problem.
So this was, so she was put in a safe house. It was a very tumultuous, scary event for her. And there's something even worse that happened to her that ties into why she hasn't released more music, but I'll get to that in a bit. She started performing at a young age. You know, she moved back in with her father when she was 15 and started performing in different local bands. Seems like from the time she was a teenager, she was performing with different groups and collaborating with different people. Right before she went to college, she spent 6 weeks in Switzerland working with this writer-producer, Soren Munir, who goes under the name Solgo. And then in 2003, she was invited to appear on Wow Factor, which is a Welsh television talent show. And she was actually expected to win. She came in second place. That gave her some exposure. And then after that, she made her debut EP, sort of after the visibility she got from the competition, three-song EP titled Amy Duffy. Now, the real turning point for her came as far as her getting to a national, international audience. It was that summer when she met Jeanette Lee, who started to manage her. And then, even more importantly, Jeanette Lee introduced her to Bernard Butler of the British band Suede.
Okay.
Who's done a lot of work as a writer, producer for other artists. It's interesting. When you think of the band Suede, would you think sort of a creative mastermind behind that would be involved in this record?
No, it doesn't. I don't hear the connection at all, really.
At all.
Yeah,
it's incredible, yet he's a big part of this sound.
Huh, interesting.
So it just shows the range that Bernard Butler has. He came really your key collaborator, primary producer, co-writer for a number of the songs. So this record took a number of years, sort of during the mid-2000s, to come together. Eventually, she signed to A&M Records in the UK, and then the Mercury imprint, right around the time they sort of revitalized that imprint under Island Def Jam Music. Core collaborators on this record were Bernard Butler and David McAlmont, but they really had a great mix of writing and session players involved on this. It's worth checking it out if you find it online. I think, you know, they had some of the musicians, the Wrecking Crew, for example, eventually they brought in, who had worked with Phil Spector, and just legendary Los Angeles session players who did some of the strings. So eventually they assembled a really impressive mix of different players and writers to take part in this, but it was a slow build. And I'm gonna read a quote from Duffy. She said, "The album took nearly 4 years to make. We had to hire cheap, tiny studios, and sometimes there would be 3 week periods between writing and recording." What that tells me is, at least what I can glean from that, is that they actually started making this record before she got signed.
Yeah.
So they must not have had much of a budget. Now, what's interesting to me about that is when you listen to this album, it's hi-fi. It's lush. It's 3D.
It is well done.
Yes, very well produced.
It's funny when you look at the time it was released and the style of it and how well done it sounds. It, if you didn't know better, you would be like, "Oh, somebody heard Amy Winehouse."
You're right on the money with that, because that was the time, a few years removed from when Amy Winehouse first broke through to international stardom. And it was right around the time Adele emerged. I remember that succinctly because I remember, Amy Winehouse had already become like a superstar. Mm-hmm. And I think the year this record came out was the year that I did a show with Adele. I think it was her first time in the U.S. And we had played a show with her at the World Cafe.
Oh, you told me about this once, I think. Yeah.
She was really nice, just very sweet. And I could tell it was like her first time coming through. I think she was doing promo, maybe just doing a few select dates. But she was great. It was just her and a keyboard player. And I kind of did an acoustic thing. You know, you never know. Like, when you're in the music business long enough, you never know who you're crossing paths with. I just thought she was really talented and really nice. I knew she had some heat around her, but who could have known that she was going to become this, superstar? Because really, she's probably the biggest artist that emerged during that time. I guess I would say, like, what is that, mid-late 2000s? Amy Winehouse, Adele, Duffy. I think there were other singers. This, like, wave of, like, great female British soul singers. Maybe you could even put Lily Allen in there.
Yeah, Lily Allen. Who we've talked about Lily Allen before.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah.
I think she's sort of, there was just a surge of these great artists coming out of Britain. And I think actually, I love Duffy. I think Duffy was ultimately maybe a little overlooked, even though this record was a huge success. This record came out in March of 2008. And they ultimately released five singles from this album. The first single, the title track, Rock Ferry. Sort of helped build her profile in Europe, but it was really the second single, the song Mercy. That became an international chart topper. I think that's the one that helped her break through here in the States. That was my first introduction to her. But it's actually the third single, which is my favorite tune on the record, Warwick Avenue. Shed a tear. Didn't have quite the success of Mercy, but still kind of kept it on the charts. And there were a few more singles that didn't fare quite as well. Album ultimately won a number of awards, including the Grammy Award for Best Pop Vocal Album at the 51st Grammys in 2009. Then she had a lot of heat around that album. She toured. She did some big festivals. She had some big appearances. There's a lot of visibility. And then she did another record in 2010 called Endlessly, which... if you like Rock Ferry, I would definitely recommend Endlessly. I'm not sure it's quite as good as Rock Ferry. And it's tough sometimes. You know, we talked about this. You have years and your whole life to make that first record, right?
Yeah.
Then you got to go out and promote the hell out of it, tour behind it, get exhausted, get worn out, and you got to deliver the second record. That can be very challenging if it's a quick turnaround. And so it's inevitable sometimes that second record may not be as strong. Now, Endlessly has some great tracks. She had some cool collaborators on that, including Questlove and Albert Hammond Jr. But I think it maybe got overshadowed by the success of Rock Ferry, and she's not released another album since then. Now, I'd always wondered about that. I was wondering what happened to her. You know, she sort of just stepped out of the limelight. I think she made a few appearances here and there, but she hasn't had a new album release since then, since 2010. Now, as of a couple years ago, we sort of all found out why. And this is the other thing I was talking about that was extremely, just devastatingly traumatizing. April 2020, she released a statement basically saying that, I guess this was almost a decade earlier, she had been drugged at a restaurant on her birthday, taken to a foreign country on a plane, and then held captive in a hotel and was, you know, sexually assaulted.
Wow.
For a period of time.
How long did this go on for?
It's a little tough to say. I mean, okay. It's tough to glean. It's tough to figure out the exact time. I assume based on, so I'll read this quote that she, around the time she sort of made the statement, she said she spent almost, in her words, almost 10 years completely alone, did a lot of work in psychotherapy. And then she said, this is now 2020 we're talking about. She said she was happy that she could leave this decade behind. But again, quoting her, I very much doubt I will ever be the person people once knew, which, understandable. Wow. I was just shocked when I read this.
Jesus.
Yeah, and I guess this is something that had been going on for a decade. She only just a couple years ago came out and spoke about it. So it's completely understandable that she's been out of the limelight, because the psychological turmoil of trying to recover from something like that
is immense.
So that was actually heartbreaking to read, because, you know, for anyone to go through something like that, you know, and someone who's, she was pretty young at the time, you know, it's just so damaging in the early part of your life to have that kind of experience. So as far as whether she'll release new music again, I imagine someone like her, who seemed pretty prolific in the earlier part of her life, was always working, must be creating new music. It remains to be seen whether she'll ever release anything. And I would imagine after an experience like that, just being out in public, just the idea of touring and being around a lot of people must be difficult.
Terrifying.
Terrifying. Yeah.
Wow.
So yeah, pretty heartbreaking turn to her story. But this first record, I think, really holds up and really showcases what a great artist she is. My favorite track on it is Warwick Avenue. I think that song exemplifies what I love about her. It's kind of that hybrid of 60s classic pop and soul. Like when I listen to her, sometimes I hear elements of like the work that Dionne Warwick did with Burt Bacharach and Hal David, or I hear Dusty Springfield and some of the records that she made with Atlantic in the late 60s. But there's more of a soulful contemporary edge to it. So it's not like straight up retro. But I think that's the sweet spot that they found on this album, is that you could hear some of those influences, even some of the Phil Spector influence in those productions, but that they made it contemporary. And to me, the production still sounds fresh. So it's not just a retro genre exercise. I think that song also showcases her ability as a vocalist. She has exceptional phrasing and dynamic to her performances. And I think when you listen to that bridge, it's a great bridge on that song. Mm-hmm. She hits this big sustained note at the end of that bridge. You're like, wow, you see the range and resonance she has. And she's very dynamic. She doesn't always, like all my favorite singers, she doesn't oversing. She just, it's all about creating an arc and building attention. But she has vocal power that she can deliver when needed.
I think like the biggest difference in her voice, when you compare her to Winehouse or Adele and that same sort of like pocket of genre, it's like her voice is brighter than those two people are.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Like I think it sort of accents the music in a different way. And I think like the entire sort of like feel and theme and like image of what I'm hearing is different because her voice is brighter than theirs are, like happier. And I think almost like she could sing the same exact song as those two would and sound like, you know, it's almost like when I hear Amy Winehouse, I get the same vibe as when I'm hearing like Sinatra or something. Like right. It is sort of like, not down, but you know what I'm saying. Like,
yeah, but there's a different kind of earthiness to it, yeah. I would say.
Yep. And that was what I noticed most about her voice, was how like just sort of, she's obviously like a killer singer, but just like a very bright presentation on her voice, which I think certainly speaks to the production on some level too, but it definitely speaks to what kind of a singer she is.
Yeah, absolutely. Her timbre is much lighter, I would say, than Adele and Amy Winehouse. She doesn't have that same kind of sultry thing, but she has that different kind of, her voice kind of sits in a different kind of place, which you're right. I wonder if that's what it is about her, not just in the production, because it's there, but in her singing, that makes me think of more of the late 60s, classic pop. Have you listened to much of like the Dionne Warwick?
No, aware.
You probably like, know a few of the tunes, but yeah, the things that the records that she made with Burt Bacharach and Hal David, they occupy a very specific place in pop music of that time. And I just wonder if even to some extent Duffy's voice is kind of what evokes more of that. Maybe it's not as deliberate, but it just makes me think of that era and that sound. Another tune, well, this was the undeniable breakout hit, was Mercy. A great track, soulful, bluesy performance from Duffy. I kind of like when she gets into that edgier part of her voice, a little more of a rhythmic attack to it. And that's just a great track.
Yeah, that song was on my list. I didn't know which ones were the singles or anything, but like it also has this, I don't know if you would call it a sample, but like there's a Stand By Me sort of like beat thing to it, whether it's it's certainly a reference, and it's like the entire thing is, and this is, you know, you mentioned like combining like the old thing and the new thing, and that was one thing that we complimented Amy Winehouse on. And I think like this song, it's just like, there's that retro thing in her voice, there's the retro thing in the din, but then like everything else around it is obviously contemporary, right? Like it obviously has like a hip hop flavor to it or something. And like even sampling something like that is something that a hip hop song would do. And I think it's like everything sort of comes together on that song in a really cool way.
That's a great point. That's a great snapshot of why this isn't just a retro album, because the production aesthetic, like you said, does have some of the more contemporary R&B hip hop aesthetic to it. And I think, you know, there's a way you could have made this record that it would have sounded very retro. You could have used some of those same production techniques from the 60s and early 70s, and it would have sounded like that. But I think they were conscious not to do that, to update this kind of sound, which I think, especially on a track like Mercy, makes it really special. And then one other tune I'll highlight is Hanging On Too Long. I know it's wrong, hanging on too long. Provides a nice change up from some of the other productions, a little bit of a moodier productions, and really showcases the nuance and dynamic in Duffy's singing. There's a string arrangement there on that one, particularly on the chorus, that reminds me of some of the Philly sound, Philly International, particularly some of the string arrangements that Tom Bell did. And actually, I should take a brief, well, we could do a whole episode on Tom Bell, but Tom Bell, legendary songwriter, producer, arranger, recently passed away. I feel like we should mention it on the pod. Stylistic spinners. This guy was a musical genius, huge part of the Philly sound. Someone who was classically trained and understood harmony and counterpoint. At some point, we're gonna have to do. Let's just bookmark that in our brains. At some point, we're gonna have to do a Philly episode. Whether we pick an album or two of that, or maybe we sample some different things. Actually, if you go to my Spotify, I have a playlist of some of my favorite Philly songs. I put that up a while ago, but I was just thinking about Tom Bell, and when I hear some of the elements on a record like this, it's like Tom Bell's influence, whether people realize it or not, is just everywhere,
right?
And especially when you think about R&B and soul music and strings and so on. But yeah, there's a string arrangement on that tune, Hanging On Too Long, that that kind of gives you a little bit of that Philly flavor. But this is a great record. Just very sad to hear about what happened to her. Hopefully she gets to a place where she's is feeling better and doing better. And I know if she does make another record that there'll be fans out there waiting, because I think she built a dedicated fan base. I think people who know this record and even the second one, these albums hold up. I think she would still have a lot of great appeal in this era too.
Yeah. It's funny, when we were talking about Daniel Johns a while ago, who said he never wanted to tour again, there's certainly like a world in which you make a record and just make a record, you know, and not have to play shows or anything like that, or play shows online. But again, I'm not in her head. And I would imagine even like the idea of being creative, like it changes what you want to say and how you want to say it. And, you know, like everything in your life does that, but something that traumatic I could see it like breaking that part of your brain a little bit. I can see it breaking a lot of part of your brains.
Almost be scary to engage in that kind of way.
Sure.
Yeah. You kind of have to dig deep to write songs. You know, you have to kind of dig into your emotions and your psyche, and that can be scary when you've been through something like that.
Sure. I mean, I think it's a lot of the reason why people don't go into therapy. You know, like people don't see therapists because they're afraid of what they know is buried, you know, and what they know
they just don't want to bring it to light.
Sure. And I would imagine on some level, writing a song and being creative in that way is the same sort of thing, you know. I loved Mercy. I really loved Syrup
don't
and Honey.
Don't you be using every minute on making a living, because we
That's sort of a slow, just sort of, but really like cool is the way that I thought about it when I was listening to that tune. And then in the same way that I really like Mercy, there's a song called I'm Scared, which is sort of like a sort of up-tempo, forward momentum, genre combining banger that I really like too. You know, it's so wild, like her story, and that I had never heard of her, especially considering how big this kind of music was set to be at this time. I would have thought I would have heard of it, you know?
Yeah, especially because you were still in rock radio at that time.
08, you're saying?
Yeah.
I was in alternative radio, but yeah.
Right, but like, this wouldn't have been on your radar, though. This was...
Well, but Amy Winehouse was, and Lily Allen was. Like, I think the thing that just to think about, like, when I was in that at the time, I think, of course, if you're in a certain format, you get fed that music more, but when you're living in that world, your avenues to all these kinds of music is just much more wide open than it would be normally. And then when you have friends that work at record labels who know what you like, you get a lot of like, hey, you'll never play this, but you should listen to this or whatever.
And occasionally you would actually play it. Correct?
Yes, well, certainly in Chicago.
To the chagrin of your corporate superiors.
Even now in sports, like I get the, I like that people know that I like music. I got a guy working, Alex G, to me that I knew when I was in Chicago. And then this was such a great text message I got last week from a gentleman at Crush. And Crush, Crush manages like Green Day and Butch Walker and Fall Out Boy and Kesha and yada, yada, yada. But I didn't know that they now represent Miley.
And, oh, really?
Wow. Right. Yeah, which is good for her. So I got a text from one of Craig Carton's friends that works at Crush. And he was like, hey, do you want to jump on Zoom later? I want to play you the Miley video before it goes public later. And I was like,
oh, snap.
I was like, come on, man. Yes.
No,
yes.
I haven't seen it. Is it?
It's good. The tune's good. Straight up pop song, which is, we were talking about Miley for a while. Like, Miley is obviously an enormous star and her music gets a lot of attention. It's been a long time since she's had like a fucking huge hit, you know?
Yeah, I guess it has. It has.
Wrecking Ball was 10 years ago. You know,
and that 10 years ago?
10 years. Bangers came out 10 years ago, which is when we can't stop. And she's had like some songs that you could say are hit-ish since, but never like a monster since then. And this song, she's always like, every album is like a different sort of like theme, like whether it's Hot AC Miley or Rock and Roll Miley or or whatever. But like this one is a very straightforward pop song that I thought was really good. But yeah.
Yeah, the record we did with the Flaming Lips collaboration was awesome.
Yes, I mean, not on any record label, Dead Pets.
Well, yeah, that
she put it out on SoundCloud.
You know, I knew her and liked her, but once we did that album, I was like, oh, there's something, there's a unique creative vision that she has that she wants to push the envelope and take chances and try different things. I always think of like David Bowie. Like David Bowie set the bar of don't be afraid to alienate your fans.
Right.
Instead, follow your creative muse because they will eventually come along with you. And I think Miley Cyrus has that same sort of spirit to her.
Well, this is a cool record, man. I've never heard of this. This is a good, I think a nice combo with Bruce, too.
Right on. Yeah, Duffy and Bruce. Duffy I like that Bruce. You thought it was Hillary Duff at first.
Yes. Well, it would have been a funny choice for you is all I'm saying.
Now I might have to just pick a Hillary Duff.
Hillary Duff record? Yeah, for sure. A reminder, if you want to suggest an album, Twitter or email at carlandrewrecordclub.com or the Apple Podcast reviews, or if you're listening on Spotify right below the player, you can do it right there. We will talk to you next time.
Stay free, my goose.